0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Liveline. Cullum O'Mungoyne here. You can call us on 0818 715 815. WhatsApp 0871 843 709. Email joe@rte.ie or text us on 51551. Anjali Sharma, thanks for taking our call.
Hello.
Hi. Can you take us back to the events of 2 years ago in Dublin?
Yeah, so it happened in like around this time only in 2021 in Stephen Green Park in the afternoon. I was like in the park and then I was going back home at around like in the evening. And then, hello.
Hi, we're listening.
Can you hear me? Yeah,
loud and clear. Thanks.
Yeah, so I was going out of the park and I got attacked by a group of teenagers. There were like five, six people who were attacked in my eye with a beer can. And after that, I like called the ambulance, not me, but other people around. They called the ambulance and security guard in the park and the Garda as well. The Garda did not arrive like for an hour and the ambulance did not show up. And then I traveled to the like hospital after 2 hours of getting injured, and when I like reached the hospital, I couldn't get the treatment which was supposed to be given to me. I waited like 4 hours in the emergency over there. And then they checked me for like 2 minutes and then sent me back to another hospital the other day. So that was bad. And I tried like all the things after that to get help, but I can't get anything. So then I stopped.
So you were leaving Stephen's Green, you were out and about in Dublin city centre. This is back in the summer of 2021, and a group of teenagers, you reckon about five or six, were they boys and girls?
Oh yeah, they were like mixed. I think they were like two girls and other were like boys, but they were like 15 or 16 in their age, maybe even less than that.
And had they shouted at you before they attacked you?
They were just like, you know, walking around and then they came. So they said something, I don't remember properly, but they said something and they just like thrown the bottle after that.
And so they had gathered around you as a group by the time the attack was taking place. You didn't have any warning of it.
Yeah, they pulled my bag and stuff from the back. So I just like, you know, looked at the bag and then the two. They didn't say anything. They said something, but I don't remember it at the moment.
And when they pulled your bag, did you think it was an attempted robbery or to attract your attention or just to harass you?
I think it was just to harass me because they didn't stole anything or didn't did anything else than like throwing the bottle and then they ran away.
And they threw an open beer can at your face and it hit you whereabouts in your face?
Yeah, it hit me on my eye, like on my right eye. And it was full of like, it was not a beer can, like it was a can, I think it was some mocktail or something because I could remember the smell of it a little bit, but it was full of it. So it was on my clothes and the can hit my eye.
And how badly injured were you before we get to, I suppose, the impact on you psychologically and the shock that you got? What was the damage like around your eye? Were you able to see out of your eye after the drink hit you?
I was not able to like see for almost half an hour because it was all swollen. And at first moment, I was like, I thought that my eyes was gone because I couldn't feel anything because of the pain. And it was all swollen and there was a cut as well, like up there on the eye. And it was all red.
And were you able, when do you recall when you went, was it at the hospital the first time that you got to look in a mirror and see your own injuries? What was your reaction?
Oh, when I saw the mirror, like in the hospital after the attack, I didn't want to see my face because it was looking horrible, very bad. I still have like some photos just to see that what has happened, but I can't. I don't even look at them because they were like so horrible. It was the white part in your eye; it was all red.
And were these teenagers ever caught by the guards? Did you make a full report on the night?
Yeah, like they called me in the police station as well, I think twice, and they took my like statement as well. And then after a while, I got a letter from them that they are not able to find anything, and so the case is closed and something like that. So I was like, I knew it will happen, because I have seen a lot of cases happening and the guard is not doing anything. So then I refused to do anything, and then I did not talk to them or did anything about it later as well.
So after you got a letter saying that they were unable to find any evidence despite presumably their best efforts to look at CCTV or anything else, they were unable to come up with any evidence as to who had attacked you.
Yeah, that is true. Like, because Stephen's Green Park, even after, like, even if you come outside of that, there are a lot of shops that have like CCTV and stuff. So I think it is just an excuse, because they don't want to work or they don't want to like arrest them. I don't think it is like okay.
But your general sense of fear at the time of the attack, had you ever been attacked like this before? And what was your, can you describe to people who may have no experience of this, what it's like to be attacked out of the blue and how it feels?
When I came to Dublin, I like heard in news in a lot of places that these kinds of attacks happen. And I used to like, you know, roam around a lot, but nothing happened to me. But when it happened to me, I didn't even have an idea that this can happen in like such a daylight. So I would just like to say to people that they should be aware all the time, even in not only just in like nighttime, but in daytime as well. Because if you see a group of those people, just stay away from them and be careful. Be like, open your eyes all the time. Keep your eyes open all the time.
And had you been nervous about groups of young people before this, or would you just not have noticed them before your attack?
Sorry?
Were you nervous of groups of young people before you were attacked, or would you just not have noticed them?
Like earlier, I used to like see them and then pass, like walk away from them most of the time. But I don't know, at like that point of time when I was walking in the park, I thought there is a lot of people, so nothing can happen in this much like crowd. And I was walking just like closely to them, and then this happened.
And had you ever had any verbal attacks before that? Had anyone ever abused you verbally in the street, or was this the first time you'd suffered an attack of any kind?
No, it was the first time when I got attacked like physically as well. So no verbal attack before that.
And at the time of the attack, you were living in Dublin?
Yeah, I was living in Dublin, like just near to the city centre in Clontarf.
But you've moved since?
Yeah, I moved to Cork City like 3 months ago. I was doing a job in Dublin, but it was a job where I had to travel like late night as well, which I didn't found safe. So I left that job when I came to Cork City, and I feel it like more better than Dublin. It is not that dangerous.
And how much of an influence did the attack that you suffered have on your move to Cork?
Sorry?
How much did your move to Cork, how much did that come as a result of the attack? Did you move basically because you'd been attacked in Dublin?
It's like kind of same as well, but I got a job opportunity here, and then I wanted to leave Dublin as well because I didn't find it safe at all. And then I got an opportunity here, so I came here because of that. And I don't feel safe in Dublin at all. Even if somebody is like throwing something just near to me, anything. Like there was one case, a boy was like throwing a pizza on somebody else, and I got like so scared because of that. So it is in my mind now that anybody can throw anything at you from anywhere.
And what happened to your social life when you were living in Dublin? You were out, it was 8:30 in Stephen's Green on a crowded street. You were attacked. Did you stop going out afterwards? Did it have an impact on your social life?
Yeah, that is true. Like after the attack for I think 3-4 months, I haven't even gone to that area. And then I went to that area after 3-4 months. I felt like goosebumps and I didn't feel right on that place. So I still avoid that place.
And on the night it happened, the other people who were on the street at the time, Do you remember anybody else reacting, any bystanders, when those people attacked you and the people you were with?
Like, the people around me, there was a group of teenagers as well there. They were, I think, in the park, and they were also roaming around. They came to us and started helping us with, like, water and stuff, and they waited with us till the security came. So that was a nice group of, like, teenagers that time.
But did anyone try and stop the teenagers after the attack? Did anyone shout at them?
Yeah,
did anyone give out to them?
Yeah, so there was a group of teenagers. There were like guys and girls, both of them. So they sent their like boyfriends to like behind them to get them, but they were not able to do it because they were too fast and they were gone in the streets. But then they came back and they said that we can't get them. But we will wait for the authorities to help.
Anjali, thanks for talking to us this afternoon. That was, if you've just joined us, it's Anjali Sharma there talking to about an attack she suffered in 2021 at the hands of a group of young people. Obviously, there's been plenty in the news about attacks perpetrated both by and on young people recently. But that's just to give an insight into some of the impact on it. She was out socialising at 8:30 in the evening in St. Stephen's Green in the summer of 2021 when she was hit in the face by a drinks bottle. Somebody tried to pull her bag off. She was a long time before she could get attention for the eye, and she was scared that she was going to lose her eye. So that's just an insight into what it's like to be attacked, a victim of an attack on the streets, and for it to happen on a public street in broad daylight in the middle of the evening. We'll be back after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungine here, 51551 for your text. Email us on joe@rte.ie or WhatsApp 087 184 3709. Pierce Stokes rescuing a couple in distress, but a couple with a difference. Tell us about the couple to whose aid you came.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having us on. So I'm a wildlife rescuer, and last week I was tasked with rescuing a couple of swans from Balbriggan Harbour.
And why did they need, these are creatures who are no strangers to swimming on the water gracefully at that, how did they need the help of a landlubber to get off the water?
Well, that's right. Yeah, these particular pair of swans, the locals call them Romeo and Juliet. They're quite well known. And indeed, when we went down to do the rescue, we had a lot of spectators looking on, very concerned. Essentially, the two swans, they live in Balbriggan Harbour. And kind of ongoing pollution has meant that Kildare Wildlife Rescue has had to rescue this same pair. This was the third time we went to rescue them because there's so much oil pollution flowing down the river into the harbour. So there's crude oil, there's diesel, petrol, there's what looks like food grease in there too, so possibly some illegal dumping going on. But the two swans, during last week, they got covered in oil, and then they cleaned themselves. So they looked spotless when we got there on Friday to the naked eye, but they'd ingested an awful lot of oil. They were very, very sick. And to be honest, once we got our hands on them, we realised that they were pretty close to dying. If we didn't get them that day or the next, I don't think they would have made it much longer. So, a tough old situation. We all know about the canary down the mine. Well, now you've got the swan in the harbour, and they're an indication of, you know, the pollution that's going on there.
And when you say they were in an advanced state of sickness when you rescued them, I mean, how do you treat a swan who's been badly poisoned like that when you eventually get them out of the water?
Well, you've got Dan Donagher there, who is the main man in Kildare Wildlife Rescue, and he is the expert on taking care of wildlife. So maybe I'll let him answer that.
Okay, but talk us through your own experience in this. How do you find yourself? How do you find yourself? How do you get trained on rescuing swans from water in the first place?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because I'm actually the person who teaches people how to rescue wildlife for Kildare Wildlife Rescue. So essentially, I've just been doing this for 10 years. And over that time, I've done as much training as I can with other wildlife rescue organizations. And then also a lot of training with first aid and search and rescue training here in Ireland for humans, so that I can learn the best practice for when it comes to doing kind of risky or dangerous rescues like this that could be in dangerous environments. So we're lucky in Ireland, we have an organization called the Oiled Wildlife Response Network. And they coordinate a group of volunteers who can respond in case there's something like an oil spill, or in this case, pollution coming down the river. So we learn how to rescue animals from hazardous environments, because the fumes that come off this type of oil, particularly on a sunny day like Friday was, it catches in your throat. It can make you very unwell. I'd be worried about the people who are working around the harbour and inhaling this stuff all the time. It's quite toxic.
But the swans themselves, I mean, they were sick and they were at death's door, as you put it. But were they in a position to defend themselves? Did they want to be rescued by humans?
Friday was a good example of the swans absolutely not playing ball. Wildlife rescue is incredibly challenging. You usually get one chance to catch an animal. They don't want to be caught. And away they go. They're more agile, they're able to fly, they're able to do all these kinds of things. And in the case of swans, they're the largest flying bird, and they are big enough to cause problems and difficulty to a rescuer. So,
how many birds? Like, what are you talking about? I mean, because when I was growing up, when I was a small kid, I was told, stay away from the swans, they could break your arm with the flap of a wing, which I subsequently then heard was a bit of an urban myth. But what kind of damage could a swan do to somebody who wasn't trained in doing a rescue?
Well, I tell you the main danger with doing a swan rescue is they are definitely big enough to make you slip and fall. And if you're beside a harbour wall, in a river, or any of those situations, you could fall, you could break an arm, you could fall into the water. So they can cause a lot of accidents to happen. That'd be our main worry. And then with all birds like of that size or animals that size, they can scratch you very, very badly with their feet. They can peck your face. They can go after you. And I'd say, you know, don't go near a swan unless they're very confident and capable.
Sharp claws, do they? Or what's the term for a swan's claw? A talon on an eagle. But what is it for a swan?
Again, you'd need to talk to Dan about that. Right. I catch the animals, but he's the expert about the biology.
We have Dan there, but I'll get to him in a second. Apart from the injury it can cause to the rescuers, what injury can be caused to the swans when you're trying to rescue them?
Well, that's a huge problem with catching animals that don't want to be caught. They fight for their lives, and with birds particularly, what we're worried about is they flap so hysterically, if you like, they could break a wing. And if a bird breaks a wing, we're probably going to have to put it to sleep. And it's why, when we did the rescue on Friday, it's why it was such a huge logistical effort, because we needed to catch these animals that were already weakened. Stress alone could potentially kill them, and they could flap and break a wing, and they'd have to be put to sleep. So we had to be very, very precise and very methodical in our approach. And luckily, like I said, we've been doing this long enough now in Kildare Wildlife Rescue that we have a pretty good strategy in place, plenty of expertise, but still every rescue is different. Every rescue has an entirely different challenge, and this was no different. The swans didn't play ball, the tide didn't play ball. We were lucky with the weather, granted. And eventually, you know, through basically the perseverance of Andrea, myself, and another local there, Paul, we managed to get the swans into a location where we knew we could catch them safely. And then we were able to catch them and go hands-on and get them out of the water and take them straight down.
All right. How long did that take you?
You know what? The actual rescue took about 1 hour, but we were there for 6 hours, waiting for the tide, waiting for the swans. Patience is the name of the game in wildlife rescue. But eventually we realized, listen, we're going to have to get Andrea to get into the water on her paddleboard and corral the swans on up the river. And that worked. And normally we avoid doing that because, you know, it's kind of a long shot anytime you get involved in water doing a wildlife rescue.
Andrea had to go out on the paddleboard behind the swans and basically shoo them towards the river, which is also, from as you tell it, the source of the pollution. So you're limiting...
Exactly.
You're limiting the time you have to get them out of the water a bit more by putting them towards the source of the pollution. It's a bit of a call to make, isn't it?
Well, we were lucky in that there was a lot of rain last week. So the rain was coming down the river, and the river had been cleaned of this current batch of pollution. But like I said, this is the third time we've taken these swans. It's constant pollution going down that river. So by taking the swans up the river, we were real lucky that we were able to, you know, be in clean water essentially for the purposes of this rescue. But it's still quite treacherous. It's very rocky. It's very slippery. Swans had a hard time going up the river. Another reason why it took so long. And, you know, what, I was on Liveline a few years ago with Joe Duffy, and he shared a video of me catching a fox. There is a video of this rescue for anybody who wants to see it on YouTube. They can just search for it, and it shows the whole thing that
we did. What do they search for? Balbriggan Swan Rescue, is it?
Balbriggan Swan Rescue, or Pierce Stokes is my name, and there's loads of wildlife rescues.
Pierce Stokes does it again.
Yeah.
I presume when you rescue a fox and you rescue a swan, you don't put them in the same barn. And where do you put the bag of grain when you're doing all of these rescues?
Again, they go straight down to Kildare Wildlife Rescue, which is a new wildlife rescue. It's made up of volunteers that have been at this for a very, very long time, but it's a new organisation there. It's in Kildare Town. It's right beside Grey Abbey, My Night Vets. So we've got 24-hour veterinary care there.
Okay.
And then we've got great facilities, but just say, we're building those facilities all the time through the support of the public. And if they can support Kildare Wildlife Rescue, I'd really, really appreciate that.
Hang on there, Pierce. All right. Dan Donner, who you mentioned there a moment ago. Dan Donner, well-oiled humans are no strangers to getting pumped out in hospitals, but how do you pump out a well-oiled swan?
Yeah, so the when the swans arrived Friday evening, they were fairly weak, and they were actually quite wet and cold. So the oil affects the bird's feathers, and the water seeps in and actually lowers their body temperature, the water. So we had to warm them up and actually quite, you know, make them stable. So they were put on fluids and then given charcoal and some other medications just to...
So the charcoal is to get rid of the poison in their system, is it?
Yeah, exactly. And the fluids help if they hadn't been eating, and especially, you know, with the transport and stuff as well.
Where do you put, by fluids, are you talking about drips?
Yeah, IV fluids, yeah.
Where do you put them? I mean, you can't, can you find a vein on a swan with all the feathers?
Yeah, so it goes into their leg. They've lovely big veins in their legs. And we're so lucky to work with Grey Abbey and My Night Vets, who are, you know, have worked with us for a few years, and the vets there will, you know, give it a good go and do the best for the animals we bring into them. So not only companion animals that they look after our wildlife patients. So they're, IV, like just the same as you would a dog or a cat or a person, and they were put on a drip.
Right. As it occurs to me there, the question I asked Pierce earlier, what do you call the claws on a swan, or the talons, or the what, nails?
Yeah, so they've got webbed feet, so they have, and they've got four nails, basically, that are they use for gripping, then getting up onto the banks and rooting around at the bottom of a canal or a river.
And do you have to sedate them? Were they in such a weakened state that they didn't need sedation, or did you have to sedate them before you started to warm them up, fit the drips? And do you have to, like, restrain them as well? Do you have to restrain them?
You do, yeah. So they were put into a walk-in kennel, it's called, where they're kind of confined. But we don't sedate the animals unless they really need to, if they were stressed or maybe a risk to the vet or ourselves.
And how do you stop them ripping the drip out of their leg by moving around? I mean, are they in a kind of a body sock? Is that what you're talking about? Or
So the vet would put vet wrap and be well bandaged in there, and then they have an extension onto the line. So if the swan needs to move around, the kind of line goes with them. So it's all very great veterinary work, you know, and they don't come out, so it's great.
And Pierce was talking about the oil going down the river and getting into Balbriggan Harbour. I mean, however the oil got there, how does Kildare Wildlife Rescue get to Balbriggan? It seems quite the distance away to have to travel in order to do wildlife rescue. Is there no Fingal Wildlife Rescue? Is there not a wildlife rescue in every county?
Unfortunately not. There's many good wildlife rehabilitators around the country, but there is not one everywhere around. So it's quite, you know, we often, all of the wildlife rehabilitators will have to go outside their main area to kind of help with the animals. There is Yvonne McCann in Hedgehog Rescue Dublin, and she does a lot around there, but we would take the bigger animals like swans and that. So we work mainly Kildare, Dublin, Meath, Leash, some of Wicklow, And Wexford, we even go as far as Wexford as well, because there's nobody there that will look after them.
And people have, as Pierce was saying there, people have nicknamed them Romeo and Juliet. Are they a couple? And have they had signets together?
Yeah, so they are a couple. The last time we rescued them was near to Valentine's Day. And we rescued, I think it was Juliet first. And we couldn't catch Romeo. So then a few days later, and on Valentine's Day, we actually got him. And then they were reunited. There's a lovely video up on social media of them reuniting and making noises and putting their necks into like a heart shape and all. So they actually did have a nest as well a few weeks ago, and they nested in not in a great location, and that was washed away. And then they tried to nest again upriver, and they had two eggs, and they were actually rescued by a member of the public who handed them into a veterinary clinic, and they're actually here now being incubated in an incubator.
And is there any chance, if those incubated eggs actually hatched out, that Romeo and Juliet could be bonded with their offspring, or would they recognise them? Is there any scent issue there or anything?
Yeah, unfortunately, they wouldn't recognise them because, you know, the birds would connect, you know, the chick and the egg would start to cheep before it came out, and they'd kind of have a connection there with the adults. But unfortunately, that won't be the case here. So hopefully next year, they'll be able to go off and breed and have a successful clutch.
Emer Alford, you're from Balbriggan. When did you first come across the swans?
Well, first of all, I want to say that we're very upset and frustrated about the situation. but they first came about, there's always been a presence of swans in Balbriggan. But during COVID, there was two swimming groups that were set up, and they really became a feature because we would have been down at the beach, you know, more frequently. And we would be watching old Romeo and Juliet coming out, and you could just see them swimming out of the harbour or taking off. And really it became a thing every day or most days. Has anyone seen the swans, you know? Now, I'm just going on from what that lady said there. They did have seven cygnets last year, and it was during the time that Romeo had to be lifted, and a lot of the public, you know, would have noticed them because it was along by the river just before they would go out into the harbour.
And what happened to cygnets?
Well, what happened was because they had to lift Romeo, she wasn't able to protect the whole lot of them on her own. That's what they would do. They would protect them once they got into the water. And one by one, they started to be lifted, you know, by seagulls, you know, unfortunately. And there was none left. And I want to tell you, we were all heartbroken. We were heartbroken because we knew once there wasn't the pair there, there was a chance that, you know, they weren't going to survive. Yeah. Yeah.
And are you swimming in this water that the swans got into distress in?
We would swim on what we call the front beach. And yes, we would swim there.
And do you encounter any of the oil or the pollution that's affecting the swans?
Yes, we have. Yes, we have. But during the months that it wouldn't be tested by Fingal, we'd know. And if it was really bad, we wouldn't get in.
All right, but the swans don't know that. You've said that they've been lifted before, but they come back,
oh, yeah.
Do they?
Oh, do you know what? They were lifted. They were only released again a few weeks ago, and they were put into Tyman Park. And I could just imagine the two birds going, "This is only a lake. We're used to open sea areas."
This is not the water I ordered.
No, exactly. So what they did was they swam to Bray, and from Bray they made their way right back to Balbriggan. And the reason that we know that they were the same two, they would have tagged them while they were in Kildare Wildlife, and they were able to, when they came back, they were able to see their tags and numbers on them.
All right, Mary Kavanagh, hang on a second there, Emer. Mary Kavanagh, you've seen them in Wicklow, the same pair of swans, have you?
No. I'm just ringing up to support Kildare Wildlife Rescue. I'm a councillor in Wicklow Town, but I've heard about the story because the swans eventually ended up in Bray Harbour, but they didn't stay because swans have a very strong homing instinct and they needed to go back to Balbriggan. But unfortunately, this is the third time in a few weeks that these swans have been oiled. Kildare Wildlife Rescue is a small little organisation. They don't have the funds to keep going to Balbriggan to try and save these swans. What's happening is complete and utter environmental damage. It should be tackled by Fingal County Council. And I'm calling on the Chief Executive of Fingal County Council and also the Minister for the Environment to get on board and try and clean up the dirty water.
Well, we do. We have a response from Fingal County Council and said they say once they were alerted, council officials from both the Operations and Environment Department went to investigate what might have been the source of the oil found in the harbour. They didn't see any immediate indication of the cause, but investigations into all potential sources are ongoing and will determine the next step to prevent further incidents. And they went on to say they have ruled out that outflows from wastewater pipes outfalls as the source of the oil and that there's no evidence of oil pollution. They say along the river or visible on vegetation along riverbanks or disposal into road gullies. Piers Stokes, going back to you on this, I mean, in your opinion, the oil is coming from the river.
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of photographs and videos and I think the locals all, generally speaking, know. And as I said to you, at the top of the show, you know, we've got the canary down the coal mine. Now we've got the swan in the harbour, and that's everywhere. And I know, you know, when you're talking about, you know, all kinds of terrible news stories and people can't get houses, people are saying, well, who cares about some swans? Well, it's important. Wildlife really is the big indicator that we have as to the state of the place. And when you see the harbour and you see the seals and the swans and how sick they are, there's something very badly wrong with what's going on in that river and many other rivers. And it's important that we start looking at them and saying, okay, if we can make this safe for the swans, then it's going to be safe for the swimmers. Right. It's going to be safe for the kids in the future.
Just to be clear, the swans are not the only animals you've rescued from Balbriggan Harbour. Have you rescued seals as well?
No, we haven't rescued seals. You can't rescue adult seals because they're so big. So, I mean, catching them will be hard enough, but you could be looking at something that's 400 kilos, so you can't rescue them. So, unfortunately, the seals, unless they're cubs or pups, they can't be helped. So you just have to look. And when we were there on Friday, when Andrea got into the harbour on her paddleboard to corral the swans, two seals popped up very curiously to have a look and see what was going on. But they're swimming in terrible oil. So that was really sad to see and to know that we can't do anything about it. And the other sad thing is to know that we'll be back there again in a couple of weeks. So I appreciate Fingal County Council's response, but everyone here in that knows we're going to be back in a few weeks. It's going to be the same story.
All right. Dan Donoher, are they still with you in Kildare Wildlife Rescue?
They are. I'm here at the centre today and they're here.
How are they looking?
Yeah, they're looking much better now. They're eating on their own and they're in a big stable unit there and they've been washed. So they're looking good. But as Piers has said, we don't know what's the next step. If we knowingly let the swans back, are they going to end up oiled again and potentially die? We also should add that when we had them in care last time, a lone male had moved into Balbriggan Harbour and got oiled and actually, when we rescued him, passed away because he was too badly sick. So, we're stuck now on what to do with the birds next.
But you have to release them back into the wild at some
point.
What state of health do they have to be in? I mean, they have natural oils in their feathers, which you seem to indicate the oil in the harbour has stripped away. Do you have to let that replenish itself and for them to be at a certain level of health before you release them?
Yeah, so the birds need to be waterproof before they get released, so to be able to, you know, be able to swim and, you know, with the rain and that, to be able to protect themselves. So we have to make sure that they're fully waterproof. So they'll be here for probably another few weeks at the least anyway. And we're hoping that we're able to get a solution in the meantime.
And do you have water? You mentioned there it's the Kildare Wildlife Rescue is around Kildare Town. Do you have a nearby body of water or do you have water on the premises that...
Yeah, so we use pools for them that they can wash in, and we use hoses then as well, and you can kind of see the beads of water forming on their feathers, and we know that means they're waterproof or if it gets underneath. So there's different methods we can try to make sure. We're you know, working on our facilities, and we hope to have funding at some stage to have proper pools here that we can rescue more kind of swans and seabirds and be able to give them a more natural situation when they are in care.
Right. What's the effect of on the animals themselves in the rescue? They would presume to have their own freedom of movement, but is there an effect of being in a refuge for a long period of time on wildlife?
Yeah, so we try to get them in and out as quick as possible because, we don't want to be causing stress and, they do want to be back in the wild. We don't keep animals permanently in our care. So we do absolutely everything we can to make sure that they're fit and healthy to go back. And unfortunately, if they're not able to go back, they would be humanely put to sleep. But that, again, it would be a last resort then after working with our vets and other professionals.
How did you get into this line of work, Dan?
I guess I just always liked animals, and I started volunteering with Kildare Animal Foundation when I was 17 and kind of went from there. But I kind of focused on wildlife because, you were getting people finding birds and other wildlife, and all they were hearing from everyone was just leave it at the side of the road, let nature take its course. And like 90% of the animals that we see are in here because of human interaction. So whether that's oil pollution or from road traffic accidents, poisoning, shooting, snaring, all sorts of stuff. But, 90% of them are coming in because of us. We're moving on to their habitat. It's not the other way around. So
right. And if you take, say, the swans in Balbriggan Harbour, you've removed them into Kildare Wildlife Rescue. Is there any chance other swans or indeed other wildlife would move in on their patch when they're gone? And if so, what effect would that have on them?
Yeah, so that's what happened last time. That lone male moved in and he was probably eyeing it up for nesting and hopefully getting a female. But he unfortunately got oiled and died. So, yeah, there is potential there, that other swans will move in, but the same issue is going to happen.
And is it a full-time gig for you?
It is. So our centre is open in Kildare Town every day of the week, and we have a fantastic team of nearly 100 volunteers now from working at the centre, admin, on the emails, and then we have a great team of rescues and transporters that Pierce has trained as well. So, it is a profession, and we want to get it recognised. It's a serious job, and we are helping, environment and biodiversity.
How did you get into it, Pierce? It all started with love in your case as well, did it?
Well, something like that, I suppose. Yeah, I've told this story many times.
Tell it again. I haven't heard it. Go on.
One Sunday, I was hanging out with a girlfriend, and Dan, who I didn't know and had ever met, I just saw a post from him on Facebook, and it said, "Would anybody in Dublin be available to help a fox?" So I turned to a girl who loved foxes, and I said to her, "Here, do you want to go on a date?" She said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, let's go rescue a fox." And it was only when she said, "Okay, yeah, let's do that," that I realised I hadn't a clue about what I was getting myself in for.
What difficulty was the fox in?
The fox, I think, now in hindsight, probably had leptospirosis, which in humans is called Wheels disease. And so it was curled up in a garden down in Dean's Grange in Dublin. So I went and I got gloves and I got a box. And
this is the one you get from, this is the disease you get from rat's urine, is it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the very one. And so we drove down, tried to deal with the fox, got it into a carrier.
Did you have any experience of this before you did this? Saw a post on social media and went, right, rescuing foxes.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's important to note, because people come to this from all kinds of backgrounds. You've got vet nurses and vets and people like Dan who have, known about animals their whole lives. I had no idea what I was at. And got the fox, brought it to Dan, and then he was putting his kids to bed, and he just so nonchalantly handled this fox, gave it care, put it away, no problem, after me being like on tenterhooks the entire time. So from that moment then, I was hooked on this thing, wildlife rescue.
Why? What changed in you on that evening, on that fox date?
A couple of things, but the main thing was helping a vulnerable creature was just so like I'd never even considered or thought of it, you know? And I just was like, wow, I really helped that little animal. But at the same time, wildlife rescue is just so challenging. It's the most challenging thing I've ever done. And it was so rewarding.
When you say challenging, like you're approaching an animal in distress, you know, in the early stages of it, are you talking about sweating palms, performance anxiety? Are you going to get it right? That kind of a feeling?
There's definitely that. Like I said, you get one chance usually in wildlife to rescue an animal. And so there's a lot riding on it. They don't want to be helped. So it's like being an ambulance driver where the patient is trying to get away from you the entire time. So we go out and we've got so many variables. You're in different places all the time. Animals have been kind of pushed to the edge of you know, geography. So we're always in weird places. And I particularly specialize then in challenging rescues where maybe animals are on roofs or down in rivers or oiled harbors and things like that. And it's just constantly a new challenge. And then the other thing is you meet the maddest bunch of people because you have to be mad to do this stuff. But
I mean, do you combine this with an existing interest in outdoors, adventure sports, potholing, that kind of thing? I mean, have you deployed other skills you've learned elsewhere into getting into mad places to rescue animals?
Unfortunately, my background was I was a lifelong martial artist and graphic designer. So two skills that are not particularly useful when it comes to wildlife rescue. But over the years, I've made a conscious effort to train myself up and get better at, you know, at all these different things, all the skills that can lead to being more successful at wildlife rescue.
Just hang on a second there. Dan, I mean, people would have seen, I know in the course of my work, driving home from late at night from this place, seeing foxes in increasing numbers knocking around the city, which presumably brings more people into contact with them and see them when they're in difficulty. So if somebody calls Kildare Wildlife Rescue and they see a fox in distress, what's the appropriate first responder action they can take before the experts arrive?
Yeah, so we have a fantastic team of people who advise, and they do that through emails. Unfortunately, we don't have the resources for a full-time phone number, and we don't want to kind of do it part-time. So our email system that was developed by Jana has a team that's trained up on animal rescue and advice. So a person would report an injured fox. They would be asked then to send a video or a photo of the animal and the situation just to get a good idea. And then appropriate advice would be given. In the case of an adult fox, they will be told to leave it there and step back, but to monitor from a safe distance. But there might be other cases where it was a baby bird or something, might be put it in a box carefully and put it somewhere warm and quiet till a responder can call out. But our email team are managed from 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. and people get a response very quickly, usually within 5 minutes.
All right. I can remember about 30 years ago on my way to school, I was going down behind a field that adjoined playing pitches on the way to my secondary school, and there was a rustle in the hedge, and there was a fox in the hedge, a young fox whose tail was caught in one of those wire snares. I think people who owned horses next to the school, they didn't want rabbit holes dug on the land that might injure horses. So they had got somebody to set wire snares along the edge of their land, and a fox had got its tail caught in it, a young fox had its tail caught. So we went down to the school and had to get, the only things that were there to hand were a leftover towel from Lost and Found, and the vice principal volunteered a fishing knife. He was a keen fisherman at the time. And we went back up, myself and three other fellas, and had to put initially the towel over his face so he wouldn't see what we were doing behind him, and then very quickly try and cut him free from the snare before he'd be able to shake off the towel and maybe bite one of our hands. Now, was that the right or the wrong thing to do?
I would advise, now that we have a team of people trained, to call the experts in, you know, because if that fox got out, maybe, you know, it would need to come into care if it was caught in a snare, because the skin can break down and there can be injuries there. So that wouldn't be the right thing to do, just let them go free. But as I said, we have a great team there who would be happy to come out and help if they can. It's not always possible. We are all volunteers, but where we can. And we work with other organisations. So if something's too far away from us or we're not able to attend it on that day, we will recommend another organisation that will be able to assist us with that.
Okay.
Colin, could I respond to your story there?
Very quickly, yeah, Piers.
Yeah, just to say, like, that's just a great story of three people, three young lads, trying to help an animal in distress.
Well, I'll be meeting them in September for a school reunion. At least one of them, I'll have to give out to them. I'll have to tell them we ended up doing the wrong thing at the end.
In the days of mobile phones, like the best thing you can do is get your exact location off Google Maps and get a good video of the animal. But the situation you were in there, I just like to say fair play to you, and I'm glad that you remember that. You know, 30 years later, it's still a good memory.
Well, I kind of have to give a nod, possibly, to Tom McCochrane, whose series of books on foxes probably gave people a lifelong interest in the life of the fox. Emer, just if these swans are released, Dan, what's the time frame on the release of the two swans from Balbriggan Harbour? How long do you think Romeo and Juliet will be with you?
They'll probably only need another two to three weeks here at the centre. So,
and Emer, you're in Balbriggan, you'll be keeping an eye out for them, will you?
Yeah, but I mean it's very frustrating because look at the time and the work that Kildare Wildlife had put into it. And, you know, the poor swans, when they're released, this is their home, Balbriggan. And they're going to come back. And the problem hasn't been resolved. And with all due respect, and I acknowledge Fingal County Council's response to it, but, you know, don't insult our intelligence. We actually see and we smell what is in the river. There's been photos taken. And okay, there are obviously other things that would be infectious, but the oil is very visible. We had only a year and a half ago had to actually stop our swim because it came right in to the front beach, and the smell on occasions since then has been quite, you know, it actually catches you. So, you know, don't consult our intelligence. It's there. There is pollution.
All right, anyway, in short, Pierce, if they are released and they do wind up in Balbriggan again, you'll be back to rescue them if needs be, but hopefully that need won't arise, Pierce.
The whole town is after them. The whole town has their back.
And Pierce, you'll come back if they need it?
Whatever rescue case Dan puts me on, I'll go and I'll catch them.
Dan, you'll answer the dispatch call, the distress call from Romeo and Juliet if it comes.
It will, and Pierce will be straight out.
All right, we're back with the predicament of Giggles the Clown and the Lost Diary after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Cullum O'Mungoyne here, 51551 for your text. WhatsApp 087 184 3709. Email us on joe@rte.ie. And hopefully some of those contact details will help the person we're next going to hear from, Giggles the Clown. Good afternoon. Fáilteachaigh Liveline.
Gáramíle maith agat, Colin.
So tell us what have you've made an almost three decades long career out of making children happy, but you're concerned that what happened to you on the bus from Carlingford to Dundalk might make children unhappy.
Well, I was actually from Dundalk into Dublin. It was the bus errand bus from Dundalk to Dublin. I was working in Carlingford that day on Saturday last, and at a communion, and then I had got into Dundalk and got a bus at 7:30 at night on Saturday night, and left my diary on the bus.
So a long day's entertaining as a children's entertainer and clown. And maybe the tiredness got to you, but the diary was left on the bus. Tell us what's so important about this diary and what it looks like.
Okay, it's a navy diary. It's an A5 diary, A5 size. And it has all my bookings in it, you know, for communions, for birthdays, for schools, for everything. Now, I've managed to retrieve, thanks to the glory of different medias. I've managed to retrieve through people's help on Facebook and different things like that. Some of the parties so far. Anyway.
But you have a nagging doubt that some of them might still be missing as a result of this lost diary.
I have a weekend. I have a party this weekend on Sunday, and I haven't a clue. It's in Dublin. but I'm going to be in Dublin anyway because I'm working in Dublin on Saturday and I'm staying up. So I'm just going to get into my costume on from the morning and just pray that somebody rings or rings beforehand and just says, where, you know, maybe where are you? And I just pop in taxi and get out there late. But at least I'm there for that child. And that's the most important thing.
So if you have booked Giggles the Clown for this Sunday, for what kind of a party is it?
It's a communion party.
So if you've booked Giggles the Clown for a communion party this Sunday, at what time?
I haven't a clue the time even. It could be around 2 or 3, roughly around that time. Okay?
And tell us, how did you get into this 3 decades ago?
Years ago, I worked with the Irish Red Cross. And in the Irish Red Cross, we had a group called the Entertainment Troupe. And the entertainment troupe used to meet on a Tuesday night. We'd learn skills from each other in clowning, in balloon making, in face painting, in costuming, in magic and everything. And then we used to go into children's hospitals to entertain sick kids. And that was the main aim. And our motto was that laughter makes the heart grow stronger. Okay. So one of the clowns in there that worked with me, unfortunately, he's deceased now. He taught me everything. His name was Jiggles, and I was Giggles. And we worked together, and we decided to go busking on Grafton Street.
In costume, as clowns, musical clowns.
In costume, as clowns, and we made balloons for people. And people made donations, and we earned quite a lot that time. Because, I mean, you earned more that time. And before the euro came in, that when the euro came in, really, it was amazing. It was an amazing time for busking in Dublin.
How did the euro? I suppose the lowest sort of middle value coin, the euro, was worth 27, the equivalent of 27 pence less than the pound coin being tossed into your basket. Is that it?
Yeah, well, not just that. I think it's different. I think people's attitudes to things and busking is different now. I think, you know. Then there wasn't as many buskers out and there wasn't as much laws around busking and everything at that stage, okay? And that people could go out and find their spot or whatever. Whereas now it's totally different. It's like it's a commercial thing now.
Right. That's when you were Dublin, you were working in the hospital, working in the Red Cross, you're going out busking on Grafton Street, but you're all over the country now, are you?
Oh, gotcha. I work with a lot of, I work across Gaeilge Freshen, so Tolong Gaeilge Gum.
All right.
So it's a big bonus to me, in that there's not any other Irish-speaking clown, which is great. Well, there may be other people, but it's just established for so long now. So I work with all the...
Right, that's quite the skill set that you've acquired then. Big shoes to fill, I suppose, not to put a...
Oh, God,
if you'll forgive the clowny pun... So I might have seen you about 8 years ago in a theatre in Mullingar at a performance by a Gaelscoil there in which is a fine theatre down in Mullingar. You were the entertainment. You warmed up the crowds beforehand.
That's it. I was working with Gaelin at the time. It would have been for Curram Gaelin, schools put on shows on the stage, and then I was the interact in between each when they were getting ready. So we was keeping a continuity to the whole day, and it works very well. I do that every year with Curran, and it's fantastic. Like, you know, it's great.
Well, I've seen you warm kids up at a party, but what do you do with a troublesome kid at a party? Somebody gets out of line, starts running around the room, not playing ball, tries to compete for the clowning activity. How do you deal with competitors at a children's party?
At a children's party, you have them all sitting there and everything like that, and you say to all the kids, now I'm going to make a balloon for the kid who's the best kid here today, the quietest kid I've ever seen in my life, and I've named that kid. Because oftentimes the kid that's running around is the kid that doesn't get any attention ever, and is only given out to all the time. So you compliment him.
But you make a joke of the fact that he is far from the quietest kid, is that it?
You compliment him. And then you say Johnny or whatever, this fictitious name, Johnny is going to be my minder for the day, and I make him into a warrior with a sword.
All right. And were you that kind of a kid, John? I mean, is that how you got into it? Did you were you the kid that would run around and create a bit of a scene in a nice way at a party?
I'd have been the kind of entertainer kind of a guy at a party. I'd have been the laugh. I'd have been the joker. I always had that little bit of devilment in me as a child, you know, and I enjoyed that. And I was always the one who would sing up and do, as you know, I'd get up and sing a song as a party piece always, or I'd recite a poem, or I'd do a funny poem, or do something, you know, the kind of way. So I would have always entertained and always enjoyed that, and making people happy. That's the main thing.
Have you ever met a child whose party you entertained at years later who has come up to you, even as a parent, and say, "Giggles, that was a hell of a party"?
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. And they remember me and they'd invite me back. And it's hilarious where you have parents now who I'm going to their kids' parties and I did their party. That's how long I'm at it. Like, it's 28 years. Like, well, it's kind of, you know, they're grown up. And then I've been at, I was at an event recently where there were two people in their 20s and I had done their communions. And the mother wanted to get a photograph, you know, so I got a photograph with them, like, again. So and it was posted up online again. And she posted up the old photograph as well. So she got the identical photograph of when they were younger.
And were you in the same costume?
Yeah, roughly the same. A different style costume. But what I would do with my costumes, I got very good quality materials, and then I upgrade them every year and get them, you know, fixed and mended, and, you know, and add more to them all the time, like, you know. So, but the materials that I would have in the costumes are long lasting
and
brilliant.
Do you make them yourself, or do you have somebody run up your costumes?
No, I have. I have a dressmaker in Gorey that does them for me, and she's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. So she knows exactly what I want, you know, the kind of way.
Are you a victim of the modern era, Giggles, because, you know, you've lost a paper diary and you do most of your travel by public transport. Would you consider going digital with your diary from here on in?
That's one thing a friend was saying to me. I need to do my diary on my phone and have it all on my phone as well. And I need to start doing that. It's just that I'm old-fashioned. You know, the way you get into your old-fashioned ways of just writing things down. I like that, you know. I just like having that diary. But I know I need to have a backup at this stage, and it's something that I will need to start doing and getting used to. It's just... it's fiddly and it's faddly and it's trying to figure out how to use things and everything. So you get it done eventually. And once you have it on your phone, you have it on your phone and you have it saved, you know, to iCloud, everything like that. So you can't lose, you know.
People can't miss you if they see you travelling the length and breadth of the country, because you do travel on the buses using public transport in costume, don't you?
I do. And people say, "You don't do that, do you?" And I say, "Yeah, I do," because, really, it's the best form of advertisement in getting seen. And then if children get on the bus, I'd often make balloons for them and I'd give out my business card. So, and I've got birthdays through that as well, you know, and you're passing out your word out there. People are getting to know you. You know,
I think that's how Daniel O'Donnell started, handing out tapes, selling them on the bus to knock. Great things come from marketing on the bus.
Yeah, honestly, unless Daniel O'Donnell can do it, I can do it.
Indeed. All right. Well, we got a response from Bus Air and John. Regrettably, they haven't been able to locate the missing diary. They've been in contact with their colleagues in Dundalk and Dublin, and they've identified the bus you were travelling on. That bus was searched again today. It was searched on the 13th of May when it was first reported missing, probably by yourself there. And they've checked with Dundalk and Dublin depots.
Yeah. They were very, very good to me, I must say, and were very helpful in every way they could. It's just whatever happened, you know. Like a diary people would think of, you know, if it was maybe a purse or if it was a mobile or something like that, it might be, you know, you'd never think of a diary, you know, but unfortunately, it may have been thrown out or something like that in the bin or whatever.
They say they'll be in touch if they locate it. That's
I know that. They're brilliant. They're absolutely. I have to compliment Buzz Aaron. I know they've been fantastic. I emailed and they emailed back straight away, and everything was done right, and they gave me numbers to get in contact with Dundalk. So I had a number, at least I had a voice to speak to, and it was great. They were very, very helpful.
All right. Well, hopefully somebody, if they have that A5 diary, Giggles the Clown, a clown of 28 years or more who has been entertaining children the length of the breadth of the country, travelling on the bus in his costume, has lost his diary. He has communion and other party bookings for the coming weekends in it. If you find it, it's vital to his livelihood. So do get in touch. We'll be back after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Cullum O'Mungain here. We heard from Giggles the Clown before the break, who's had more or less the same costume on him in his 28 years of entertaining. And yesterday we were speaking to people who have hung on to clothes that they really are attached to for decades in some cases. Nicola Everard, what's your favourite item of clothing?
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you? And I, dare I say, who are you wearing?
Well, I'm not at the moment, actually. Not wearing at the moment, but I have a very favourite suit that I wear on occasion, which my mother made in the 1960s. So it's a very classic Chanel tweed suit with a round collar, and it's a winter suit. You know, it's brown, shades of brown and light turquoise. And, so it's 60 years old.
And she made it herself?
She did, as they did in the 60s. They made a lot of the clothes themselves. And, well, she would have made clothes for us growing up as children out of old curtain fabric, you know, to sort of, you know, save pennies along the way.
Right, a regular Maria von Trapp.
Completely, yeah.
And no, were you proud of the clothes she made for you as kids?
We didn't know any different. they were clothes, you know. We were told to put them on, we put them on and wore them.
Right, and this Chanel-style suit, where did she get the idea? She worked in clothing, did she?
She actually, would you believe, she was a very trendy mother. She was a DJ in London in the 60s, a disc jockey in a club.
Really?
In a nightclub. So, yeah, you can't have much trendier than that, really, as mothers go.
Do you rebel against a mother as trendy as that? Did you become a lifelong conservative?
Not at all. No, I tried to keep up with her, you know, tried to keep up with her. But she was great. That was her night job, and then she had a day job. But they made a lot of their own clothes back then, and she made this wonderful suit from a pattern, Chanel style, so classic that obviously I can still wear it today, and I do on an occasion.
Still have the shoes to go with it, do you?
Well, not quite to go with it. But they're her shoes, and they're classic retro. So
you must be a ringer for her, both build-wise and fit and everything, are you?
Oh, I get away with it. I get away with it.
Right. And Camilla, how did she balance work in a department store by day and DJing in the hectic 60s London by night?
Well, they obviously worked hard back then. They worked very hard, and she managed both. I don't think my grandfather knew about her night job, but he definitely knew about the day job in a department store. She was a buyer. She used to buy clothes for the department store.
And is that where she got the ideas for, you know, her own designs of clothes as well? So she'd see stuff
Absolutely.
She liked and run up a copy herself.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, they used to, you know, make things from patterns, and she'd obviously bought the pattern and made this classic suit, this tweed suit, that I still get great wear out of at the age it is.
And did she ever tell you how she hid the records so that your grandfather didn't know she was going out at night to play them for the entertainment of London's hipsters?
So she lived in London. My grandfather didn't live in London, she was a DJ in a nightclub in a hotel. So I think everything was kept there on site.
Right. Any celebs cross her path while she was DJing?
Oh yeah, I think they all the 60s swingers were there. I'd say crossed her path.
Really?
Yeah.
Did she ever mention any names, or did she have any good yarns about the faces of the '60s, as I think they called them then?
Yeah, she did. She did, but I can't remember. And sadly, my mother's no longer. She moved on about 6-7 years ago. So,
Sorry to hear that. And was she a stylish woman? I mean, she would have had to arrive into work the next day with her hair and makeup all done up. Did she keep her hair short in a bob to make that a bit easier in the '60s?
Yes, she did. She was classic. She dressed classically, you know, and coolly. And then she moved over to our back home here in 1968, still wearing her mini skirts, you know, which many of the local farmers weren't used to.
She caused a bit of a stir, did she?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Very much so.
And, you know, people have a variety of reasons to hang on to vintage clothes. Some of them is it gives them a connection to the era, or it's the style they like. But when you wear your mother's clothes, does it give you a kind of a connection of the time you had with her and your memories of her as the trendy mother?
Absolutely. Yeah, it really does. And keeps her alive, keeps her, you know, memory alive.
People so, see what you're wearing and ask you about it. Presumably you can tell them about her, is it? It becomes a bit of a conversation point.
Completely, you know. And, yeah, timeless. A timeless classic tweed suit. You know, three-quarter length sleeves and, yeah, no, very comfortable and very wearable to occasions. Yeah, comes
right
out quite a lot still.
Well, well may it wear. Dolores, you have a garment.
Thank you so much.
You're more than welcome. And thanks for telling us your story. Dolores, you have a garment you plan to pass on to your daughter. How long have you had it? What is it?
That's great, Colm. It's a blouse my mother bought me for my 16th birthday in 1976. And so I still have it. And my daughter, who is over 41 now, she wore it one night to a nightclub. And now I still have it. And I intend keeping it for my granddaughter, who is 9. I'm giving it to her for her 16th birthday.
Well, describe this blouse, because hopefully it'll be. Is it of a type that was timeless? Would it fit in any era? And do you think your daughter will wear it when she turns 16? What is it? Give us a description.
Well, I'm not sure if my granddaughter would wear it.
Or your granddaughter, excuse me.
Well, it's quite trendy still, and I thought it was beautiful at the time. And my mother had great taste, and it's beige in colour. And there's images or logos on it of two people in a boat, one sitting holding an umbrella, and the other person is rowing the boat. And it's in fairly good nick now. It's a little bit flimsy, but it's beautiful, and it's precious to me because, as I say, my mother bought it for me, and she wouldn't have bought much because she, like your last caller, she made everything we wore, but she had marvellous taste, and so it's special. She's now passed on, so it's just, I suppose, for me, it's very special.
For someone who made her clothes, this particularly caught her eye, anyway. And where did she buy it?
It's actually, would you believe, St. Bernard is written on it. And I see on it as well, made in Ireland, which I'm glad to see. So, it would be unusual for my mother to buy clothes because she made absolutely everything we wore. I distinctly remember dressing for my confirmation on my 11th birthday, with a beautiful outfit that she made for me from head to toe.
All right. Well, I hope a few more generations get a wear out of that. Fergus, yeah. You still have a Crombie coat in the family. How old is it?
It's the same age as I am. It's 78 years old.
And still going strong.
And I only wear it at funerals.
Right. It's black then, obviously, is it?
So it's black, and it's got the most wonderful satin lining, and the pockets were velvet inside, but they're worn now. But it's perfect. It's wonderful.
And you only wear it at funerals. So you have mixed feelings, really, with wearing it.
Oh, no. I love wearing it. And I tell everybody that it's the same age as I am. I, you know, it was made for my father the year I was born.
And where was it made, or where did it come from?
Oh, I really, it's interesting. I haven't looked at a label on it. It's amazing, yeah.
All right.
No, I don't know where it was made. It might have been made in Dundalk, I mean, where he lived all his life.
Well, maybe you should take it out on birthdays as well as funerals, and you can celebrate every anniversary with the age of the coat. Well, congratulations for keeping it in such good condition. We're back after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.